From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Rilott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis provides another update on Syria as the White House and Congress debate a response to the use of chemical weapons in the country.
At least Assad has an address. When we want to punish him and make a point, we know where to send the missiles. He has a capital. This is the problem. There is no government in waiting in Syria.
And later, Chad and Tara Jordan join me for a conversation about aid and development.
When people are used to getting handouts and they're used to sort of having everything arrive on a big shipment, you kind of become used to that.
The siblings and Oklahoma natives founded an organization to make international philanthropy more efficient.
It's kind of the idea of getting away from charity and harnessing the potential of business to empower people.
Now news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Rilott. Rebecca Cruz, Joshua Landis, Roundtable Time. More big news on Syria this week about the United States perhaps preparing for military action. Are they going to bomb? Are they going to do it lightly? Are they going to go in full force? We don't know
how hard they're going to hit Assad, but clearly they're going to hit Assad. The fleet is there. The world is prepared. Public opinion has been worked on. And what they're going to do, I mean, there's two different issues here. There's a civil war in Syria, and then there is the use of chemical weapons. And what Obama articulated very clearly is that we can hit him hard enough to dissuade him from using chemical weapons again and preserve the international norm, which has existed since the end of the Second World War, not to use weapons of mass destruction. And that has been valuable. It's worked. Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons briefly, but that's been the only exception to 60 years, really, of not having weapons of mass destruction. So it's worth it to try to extend that and make and punish Assad and make him think twice about using it again.
But you're going to punish him how? So he uses weapons of mass destruction. We respond with conventional weapons against the government of Syria. But in what way?
I mean, well,
so McCain
you,
says take out the Air Force. Take out, you know, hit him hard.
Well, the problem is if you get sucked in, if America gets sucked into the civil war, that's a whole other problem. Syria is a country of 24 million people, and the country is split into two, fighting. Over 100,000 people have been killed so far. If you take out the government, the opposition is going to sweep in and conquer all the places held by the government. And we don't have a partner in the opposition. The heaviest fighting forces in the opposition are al-Qaeda or Salafist groups that are very anti-American. If they win, they're going to get all the chemical weapons. Then we'll have an even bigger problem because at least Assad has an address. When we want to punish him and make a point, we know where to send the missiles. He has a capital. These other groups don't. There are 1,000 militias in Syria. We will not know who owns them. If al-Qaeda gets them, then we've got a real problem on our hands. This is the problem. Is there is no government in waiting in Syria. America for 2.5 years has been trying to organize the Syrian opposition into a government in waiting, and they failed.
Russia, China still say no. What are we to make of that, or does that affect our decision whatsoever?
Well, they're saying America should not be the policeman of the world, and they don't want America to use this as a pretext to bring Syria into their sphere of influence and to take it out of Russia's sphere of influence, for example. There is still a big power game going on in the world, and this is about realpolitik. And so they're protecting their clients.
Meaning power politics. We're playing out power politics here among Chinese, Russians,
a lot of clients,
United States, and its allies. So Syria now, this action in Syria is now kind of like some sort of proxy for
it is a proxy war.
Conflict,
it is a proxy
latent conflict, or at least lack of cooperation among these major powers of the world.
Absolutely. And it's not sure that we're going to be able to dissuade Assad from using chemical weapons again. I mean, this is a bloody war. His back's against the wall, as is the opposition. And, you know, in war, the point is to kill your enemy. In the Second World War, the United States used the atom bomb. We firebombed Dresden. We killed 100,000 people at a whack because we wanted to kill our enemies. And in a sense, that's what happens. And that's the pressure on Assad to use the weapons he has and to kill his enemies in bigger and bigger numbers is going to mount. So it's not clear that just blowing up a bunch of his buildings, for example, killing some of his top people, is going to necessarily dissuade. Because if he begins to lose in the long run, he's going to use everything he has.
And what's the public opinion on the ground? I mean, with this chemical weapons in Syria, what are we hearing from them, if anything?
Well, we're hearing two different stories, like you would imagine in a civil war. The opposition is thrilled. And they are hoping that this is going to be hard. They're worried that America is only going to slap them on the wrist and isn't going to do enough. They're hoping that this will turn the tide and finally get together the coalition that's going to sweep in and save a lot of Syrians from a terrible fate. On the other hand, half the Syrians are still under the government control. And they're worried that if the government falls, these militias are going to sweep into cities like Damascus and take over, potentially stealing their cars, their businesses, and that they will be dispossessed. So there are two sides to this.
Well, undoubtedly, we'll return to this issue as we wait to see what the United States will do in this case.
Well, I think that's what the United States is worried about, is that things could get worse if they take out the government. And they're very loath to want to take responsibility if things do get worse.
Joshua Landis, thank you very much. Rebecca Cruz, for being with us on the Roundtable. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show and answer any questions you may have. You can leave a comment about this discussion online at kgou.org or send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU. In a moment, Chad and Tara Jordan join me to talk about humanitarian aid and development. The siblings and Oklahoma natives founded an organization to make international philanthropy more efficient. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. Chad and Tara Jordan grew up in Oklahoma and earned degrees in international studies from George Washington University and the University of Oklahoma, respectively. Together, they founded the consulting firm Cornerstone International to teach businesses, charities, and churches how to make the most out of humanitarian aid. Chad Jordan has also written a book called Shut Up and Give, Eradicating Global Poverty by Breaking the Cycle of Dependence We Created. Tara Jordan, Chad Jordan, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So you do work in the international development sector. How do you get involved in that and why, considering here you are, both of you, from Oklahoma, right? Tara, you're a graduate of the University of Oklahoma. Chad, you didn't go to OU. You went to George Washington. But anyway, you're from Oklahoma, and you're involved in international development work. You started your own development company. But tell us what that means, an international development company. What is it that you do, and what are we supposed to understand about international development work?
One of the big focuses that we have is really working on the ground. That's something that from in between undergrad and grad school, I spent some time in Africa and Asia, just working with some nonprofits and some NGOs, volunteering, helping with business plans, just basic things that I was really able to go and observe and listen and just really be there on the ground with the people, which really instilled in me that was something I wanted to do and wanted to be involved in. So after I finished grad school, I could have gone to work for a Deloitte or a larger, you know, consulting firm like that, but I really wanted to make sure that I focused on the ground and really being able to work and empower people with that.
So working on the ground in countries that would be considered poor countries, right? So the kind of work then that's related is what exactly? Helping them do what?
We do a lot in the realm of financial services, which can be working with microfinance, small and medium enterprises, developing business training, business plans, things like that. I think that was sort of by accident that's happened, but it just seems to be that a lot of the projects we've gotten and the people we've contacted and worked with have been in the financial services realm.
We work a lot with financial inclusion, helping people gain access to financial services that are not available through traditional methods in their own countries. So microfinance is a huge part of that, lending to small and medium-sized enterprises, as he mentioned. We also work a lot with people who are, you know, trying to come up with creative solutions to empowering people to lift themselves out of poverty. So whether that's volunteer tourism, setting up a different sort of an NGO where you're training people in business practices and business strategies, how to save money, different healthcare services, things like that. So really just trying to empower people to the point where they can lift themselves out of poverty.
Well, I want to get to that in a minute, but just to be clear, microfinance, obviously, small loans directly to individuals, small amount of interest. These are just the ability to help the average everyday citizen in an up-and-coming or a developing country, open a bread shop or some, you know, way to cut hair, whatever, a salon. But when you say financial inclusion, is that what you is micro lending a form of financial inclusion, or what is financial inclusion?
Microfinance is a huge part of that. When we talk about microfinance, the involvement that we've had is beyond just the capital. It really is about savings. It's about insurance. It's about educational loans and things like that. So when we talk about financial inclusion, it's not just access to capital that you could use to start or grow a business. It really goes beyond that into things that the average person, like you mentioned, would not be able to access from a traditional lender in a lot of these nations. So it's really helping them gain access to these things that are going to allow them to move forward in a way that they're empowering and sustaining themselves and not so reliant on continued support.
Such as having a savings account or having access to a construction loan to where they can build a newer and better home or a sanitation system in their home, having access to an educational loan for their children or for themselves so that they can begin to move forward and kind of get out of that cycle of continual poverty. And banks that operate in underserved countries usually have very limited access for the upper echelon of people. So we're really trying to open that up, and financial inclusion includes savings, different types of loans, definitely micro lending for people to grow their businesses as well. So it includes all of those aspects.
So how does this differ then from what we would consider kind of traditional approaches or something like foreign aid? I mean, you've mentioned in some of your previous writings that you've noticed the failure of traditional approaches. Would that include foreign aid? Has foreign aid, as we understand it, government to government aid, has that failed as a mechanism for development?
I would say yes, just because I think in my experience, I lived in D.C. I have a lot of friends and colleagues who work at USAID. They have passion. They're very, very involved in what they do. But I just think that there's been an issue in the way that it's been done that has not proved effective. You know, I was in Haiti after the earthquake in 2010, and Haiti is one of the largest recipients of foreign aid and has been for the past 20 years. But the infrastructure that was there even in place before the earthquake was horrible. You know, there was very few people have access to sanitation. Very few people have access to financial services and things like that. And to me, that really shows a failure in the billions and billions and billions of dollars that have been pumped into the country. It's really been used for projects that are corrupt and things like that. It doesn't really go toward projects that are really sustaining people and focusing on business. We've talked about it here a little bit already, but one of our big issues is that we want to focus on business solutions. You know, we really believe that poverty is going to be overcome when the intersection of business opportunity and social responsibility is really where we believe that poverty can be tackled.
So business solutions meaning getting small amounts of money or smaller amounts of money mm-hmm. directly to individuals who are going to open businesses, create wealth for themselves, or at least a greater opportunity in terms of a greater standard of living, but also perhaps creating jobs. I mean, what kind of businesses, when you say business opportunities, business solutions, are
you
talking about?
When you look at, you know, the opportunities for developed nations to invest in underserved economies where there are being jobs created for just the average person, for the bottom of the pyramid populations in underserved countries in Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, wherever it might be. So it's not just helping them grow their own businesses, that is a very large part of it, whether it's through micro-lending or through lending to small and medium-sized enterprises. But it's also looking for opportunities to not just give a handout, but give a hand up. So saying, okay, in what ways, where are we producing our goods now? Is there an opportunity for us to produce them in an area where we could employ some of the most impoverished people? So, you know, just really looking for business opportunities and creative new ways to kind of harness the potential and really the labor forces of these underserved economies, because, you know, they need jobs, they want to work. And that's not taking anything away from the developed nations either. But there are a lot of opportunities for business to really give a hand up rather than a handout. It's kind of the idea of getting away from charity and moving toward using business and harnessing the potential of business to empower people.
And this is what you mean by empowerment and enabling people to actually help themselves
exactly.
as opposed to being a recipient of
exactly.
aid and assistance, right?
Foreign aid often creates dependency, meaning that when people are used to getting handouts and they're used to sort of having everything arrive on a big shipment, you kind of become used to that. Who wouldn't? You know, I would be the same way if I was always waiting on the next shipment of food or T-shirts or shoes or whatever.
But sometimes this is necessary though, right? I mean, you need to have relief services, for example, after
disaster. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Extreme poverty relief, absolutely. But you see those sorts of practices going beyond disaster relief and being used as a strategy for foreign aid from developed economies. And that's what we're trying to get away from in terms of if you're going to go on a mission trip, if you're going to donate money, if you're going to do all these things that the average person wants to be involved with, let's think about it in a different way. You know, rather than sending over all of our things we don't want, T-shirts, you know, from developed nations, okay, is that going to hurt anyone on the ground? Thinking about the impact that our donations will have and really just thinking through the process of, okay, if I'm going to give my dollars, where can I send it that's going to have the largest possible impact over the longest period of time? So really thinking through your giving strategies.
My guests are Chad and Tara Jordan, siblings from Oklahoma who founded the consulting firm Cornerstone International to teach businesses and non-governmental organizations how to be more efficient with their international humanitarian aid. We'll talk more right after this short break. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm speaking with Chad and Tara Jordan, a brother and sister team from Oklahoma who founded the firm Cornerstone International. When we left off, Tara described how organizations can rethink their giving strategies to make sure that their donations have the greatest impact while minimizing harm to the local population and businesses. So as part of this strategy, trying to encourage or incentivize companies in the developed world to invest in the developing world and engage in some kind of social entrepreneurship model where they're earning money and making money as an entrepreneur would, but they're doing so in a socially responsible way. Is this part of this overall
Absolutely.
Development strategy?
Entrepreneurship is a huge part. When I say business, that really encompasses entrepreneurship as well. One of the things that we talk about and we deal with a lot is the idea of CSR, corporate social responsibility. I think it's a phenomenal concept. I don't think it goes far enough in really being able to invest in developing communities. You know, oftentimes when you get CSR, it's corporations that invest in the communities in which maybe they act, which is great, but it doesn't take it nearly far enough in really investing in outside communities that are in developing countries. So we've used a term called CSI, which is corporate social investment. It's a term that's used quite a bit in South Africa. But it really is the idea of going beyond social responsibility. It's part of CSR, but it really takes it to the next level, and the corporations are choosing to invest in communities that maybe they don't have an invested stake in, but it really is going on and you know, pouring whether it's capital or business training or just other forms of support that they can use to be able to lift these communities up, which is also a great marketing tool to their consumers because it really shows that they're concerned with more than just the basic bottom line.
And we've seen that be successful in Bangladesh with Grameen Veolia Water is one of the programs that we've seen success with, and also Grameen Danone, which is the Danone yogurts that we know here in the United States, is a French company. And they've really invested in Bangladesh over the last few years and are booming. I think they're having great success. It's kind of been trial and error. But you do see a lot of larger corporations starting to think outside the box and think of more creative ways to still have your bottom line of profit, but you're adding that second bottom line of social good and social responsibility. Richard Branson speaks about this all the time, the idea of conscious capitalism. So it's kind of a trendy thing right now in the business world, and we're happy to see that coming about. We want it to really have an impact in terms of pure development as well. So hopefully people will take that strategy and move forward with it.
So you wrote a book recently, Chad, Shut Up and Give. Great
yes.
title. Is this the bottom line here, is that we should stop talking about development and putting it into poverty and actually give? And when you mean give, what exactly do you mean? We give our money or is there more that we can give? And so, you know, tell us, what is it that we need to do?
I think the whole premise, which is really what we're focused on with our consulting firm, is really just rethinking the way that we give. I'm in no way saying that we should stop giving. I think giving is absolutely a huge part of eliminating poverty. But I think that we need to be a little bit smarter in the way that we do it. And as Tara was mentioning, not focusing just on charity and handouts that over time perpetuate dependency and create even more issues, but focusing on giving in a way that's really going to support business growth, national GDP growth,
employment,
new jobs.
Education.
Absolutely. I think that's really the bottom line. The focus of the book is really that and delivering some solutions to poverty that we've seen work in a lot of our experience around the world, some solutions such as microfinance and business training and social business and CSI and things like that that we've been talking about here that are really that we've seen in the field and really be effective.
And the idea of the title overall is we've been told to just shut up and give and write a check for so long. But at the base of that, we're not asking the right question. So it's really about, OK, I'm told to shut up and give. Is that what I'm supposed to be doing? Am I supposed to just blindly write a check year after year for my year in giving? Or should I really be asking the right questions? And that's what we want to encourage the population at large and especially business owners and investors to do in their giving.
And to be able to see some results, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, I think that's the one thing that the data would show is that mm-hmm. people are more likely to give or to become involved if they can see the evidence, right?
Absolutely.
They can see the results of their investment. And so how these kinds of micro finance activities, social entrepreneurship, I mean, how do we measure that outcome? And can we see it? I mean, is it evident as the rich become richer and give more that the poor also become richer? I mean, what is this relationship here between prosperity and poverty, if you will?
I think the relationship is that all boats can rise at the same time. But I think the caveat is that as boats rise in both the West and in some of the underserved nations, there has to be an understanding that it's not just for me, it's for the greater good. So I think as a boat rises in the West, it really is focusing on philanthropy and giving back and making sure that you're not just hoarding the money to buy a ski lodge or whatever that looks like, but really being aware of what the rest of the world is like. And I think that maybe comes a little bit more naturally here in the United States because philanthropy and giving is very much a part of our society. But I think you have that in some of these underserved countries when businesses grow and they hire more employees and their revenues increase, there's the philanthropy is not as established. That base of the idea of philanthropy is very new to a lot of people. So I think that's something that, you know, changing that mindset is going to be really important moving forward, that as those boats rise, there needs to be an understanding of giving back and that it's not just for you, it's for your community and your nation.
And the sharing of capital is important, but the sharing of knowledge capital is equally as important. So, you know, if you have a lot of developed companies here in the United States or in the United Kingdom, for example, who have expertise in a certain area, sharing their knowledge is just as valuable in some instances as sharing their own money capital, right. Whether it's communities or nations or companies in the underserved economy, whether it's Latin America, Africa, wherever it may be.
Well, Chad and Tara, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. It is clearly a challenging problem that we face, this issue of development. And so we appreciate your work and sharing with us your perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. We're glad to see the conversations rising up around the country.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to my conversation with Chad and Tara Jordan, siblings from Oklahoma who founded Cornerstone International. You can see a slideshow of images from their work and read an excerpt of Chad's book, Shut Up and Give, on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and we welcome our intern for the semester, Hillary Gibson. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Rolotte.